Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
So much data, so little time. What the feds are going to do with it now that they've got it. And we begin a new series on the program today about you and me and the consumer economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Netflix Instant Streaming. Thousands of TV episodes and movies on your computer or mobile device instantly streamed by Netflix to save you time, money, and hassle. Free 30-day trial now at netflix.com/APM.
This is the Marketplace Podcast for Monday, the 10th of June. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us. Coming up a bit later in the broadcast, our series, Consumed. We all want stuff. Right? We're Americans. We want what we want when we want it. That's what makes this consumer economy go round. But how long can that keep going on? More of Consumed straight ahead. First, though, even as the NSA story takes a turn toward Hong Kong, the last known location of Edward Snowden, the former contractor who has confessed to the leaks, there is more to tell about how the government is handling the enormous pile of data it now has its hands on. The Wall Street Journal reports today that the NSA has relied on technology developed in the private sector to do that. Open source software, apparently, called Hadoop, that runs circles around what the government had in-house. Marketplace's David Gura gets us going.
The people who developed Hadoop call it software for scalable distributed computing. Carnegie Mellon computer scientist Garth Gibson translates that into plain English. He says it's used
to process a huge amount of data in a relatively short period of time using a lot of computing resources.
Hadoop takes the data and breaks that into smaller pieces so thousands of computers can split up the workload. It's part of Yahoo's search engine, it's behind Facebook's social network, and the government can use it for surveillance to find patterns. Amy Apon chairs the Division of Computer Science at Clemson. She says to think of Hadoop like a gas station.
They have rows and rows of gas pumps, and lots of cars can pull in and get gas at the same time.
More computers, more efficient. The government relies on Hadoop and systems like it because they work well, they've been improved over time, and they're not that expensive. Carl Howe is a tech analyst with the Yankee Group.
The government wants to use the most cost-effective technology it can to accomplish its goals. I mean, it's no different than any other business.
But the government is not leading the way here. Ken Berman teaches computer science at Cornell. He says the companies that have developed distributed computing programs like Hadoop have an edge. They've used open source to collaborate. They've outspent the government on innovation. And
all that investment has created a very powerful technology base.
One the government just can't match. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
We're all way smarter now than we were a week ago about PRISM and FISA and all the ways that our data is gathered without us knowing about it. Now, though, a story from the other side, the side where we knowingly and willingly offer ourselves up for surveillance. There's news today that Google is close to buying a company called Waze. It's a mapping app made by an Israeli company, sticker price more than $1 billion. Its maps basically via crowdsourcing. Waze tracks people with their permission through their smartphones. It then generates maps and traffic data that can be used by other drivers. Waze now has 47 million users, hundreds of millions more when and if it joins up with Google, revealing perhaps that the line between us being happy we're being tracked and being weirded out by it can be very, very thin. Marketplace's Queen of Kim reports.
Waze is basically a GPS app. Punch in your destination and it gives turn-by-turn directions. But what makes Waze stand out is that it gives real-time traffic information by asking users to volunteer their locations. Chris Silva is an analyst at the Altimeter Group. He says, let's say Waze notices you're going 5 miles an hour on the freeway.
It'll actually ask me, hey, are you in traffic? Report your traffic status now.
Or
if I see an accident or a speed trap, I can report that information and it all gets compiled into a database.
And it all gets shared with other Waze users. Andreas Weigand runs a social data lab at Stanford. He says the difference between surveillance and crowdsourcing is transparency. But users also have to feel like they're getting something useful back.
People understand that in order to get real-time traffic information, you need to give information.
And it's that give and take that Google is trying to get more of. That's one of the reasons it's interested in Waze. Google wants to make its map more social by getting users to contribute, say, information about what restaurants they like and where they're meeting their friends. Then Google can sell ads against it. But Altimeter's Chris Silva says that the news of Prism and Google's involvement in turning over data to the government might put a chill on Waze's crowdsourcing efforts.
I think for a certain portion of users, they may start wondering, well, where does this data end up?
And if under Google's watch, they might get more watching than they signed up for. In San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, status quo. You could say we'll have the details when we do the numbers. This is, as you know, a consumer-driven economy. You've heard it a zillion times here and elsewhere. Consumer confidence, consumer spending, consumer sentiment, consumer debt. Our money makes this economy go round. What we're after this week in consumed is whether we can actually afford that in the long run.
We want more. We want more.
Here's how to order.
Now, how much would you pay?
But you can see it's worth it.
Call now, because you're worth it, worth it, worth it.
Think about what happens on any given day in the consumer economy. Somebody out and about just running some errands.
So here's the deal. I need a new pair of running shoes. Am I supposed to just find a salesman?
You know what's funny? No price tags on any of these. Am I shallow if I shop for shoes based on how they look? Probably.
Total comes out to $119.89.
There you go. $119.89 for a pair of shoes. And the guy said to me, you know what a lot of people do? Is they buy two pair of shoes.
I came in here for a propane tank, a couple of sets of light bulbs, and a soap dish for the shower in the kids' room. And here I am standing in the grill section looking at grills, which amuses me because I have a grill. Does anybody ever walk in here and go, there are just too many choices?
No.
Come on, really?
Really? $21.99 on my hair. That's what I'm spending, you know, to make my hair look pretty, right?
Oh, you know what's happening? I'm getting more gray in the back of my hair, man. That's
not my fault, okay?
No, it's not your fault. No.
My Saturday in the consumer economy?
Made.
New propane tank, sneakers, and a haircut. What else do you need?
Thank you for visiting.
Let me give you that receipt.
Of course.
One of my days in the consumer economy, obviously, but just one of them. Nothing special. Really, the same thing lots of us do all the time. A couple of stores, a much-needed haircut. But you multiply that by a couple of 100 million people, and you start to get a sense of how a pretty fair chunk of this economy is based on just the things we buy. So here's where the value judgments come in. Is it worth it? Can it last? Is it right? The good news is I didn't have to buy anything when I went to register my daughter for soccer last weekend before the haircuts and the hardware.
All right, whoa. Soccer? What? I'm sorry, I got to stop you there,
Kyle. Scott, you know we're doing a show, right? You know that?
Well, yeah, and I'm in the show. We're doing
Scott,
this.
Scott Tong from the Sustainability Desk.
We're doing this series called Consumed
this week.
But I have to tell you, the Tongs are all in on soccer.
Okay.
I mean, minus the minivan. I mean,
I got the minivan.
Well, I got three kids playing and two in this peculiar subculture known as travel soccer.
Oh, yeah.
So if you add up all the fees here and the cleats and the gas for the carpool, I mean, we're talking about a car payment just about.
Yeah, we are. But why, right? Why are we doing this? What are we doing?
We want mobility, right? We want your kids and my kids to chase a couple rare spots in college someday.
Yeah.
And so to get there, if you want to play high school sports, you have to pay. If you want to play the oboe and to be good at it, you have to pay.
Yeah.
Right? If you want a good suit to interview in, you have to pay or to live in the right school district. So we're all kind of part of this.
It's the long game, right? That's what we're playing.
Well, your family, mine, everyone in between. So where I went to tell the story was a very middle-class suburb of Washington called Charles County, Maryland.
Yeah.
Very diverse. Houses there sell for about $300,000. And there, Kai, I found the Jackson family. Spent a few days keeping up with them, or trying to, because at 2 o'clock in the afternoon there, the madness starts.
18-year-old Jada flies in and out first.
I'm gonna call Coach Brandon in the car.
So a track and student government star, she's off to her personal trainer.
Mom.
Yeah.
Hey, Mom.
Next in, basketball stud Cameron, age 12, shoe size 11.
Hey, Mom.
What are you doing?
And then sixth grader Connor checks in by iPhone video from his bedroom. The boys sprint through clarinet practice, homework, tacos for dinner.
Come on, get your stuff, let's go!
Then mom Nikki gets him out the door. Try to keep up here. Cameron has a basketball game. It's his county team, not his select travel team. Annie plays baseball and, separately, all-star baseball, plus football workouts on Sundays.
Take over. Do what you gotta do. What did I tell you? Take over.
Hands up, Brett. Come on.
Connor plays three sports, too, plus all-county orchestra. Tired yet? Or hear yourself in this? Welcome to the new parenting arms race. Like the Cold War arms race, each side or each family invests in an arsenal. Except it's not ICBMs. It's trophies, accolades, newspaper clippings. It's the currency of college and job resumes. Once, only the wealthy ran this race. Now families like the Jacksons have their own lane, too. So, what's the cost? There are several ways to look at this. First of all, sleep.
My alarm is set for 4:15. Get up, shower up.
That's Dad Lewis Jackson behind the wheel. He's a facilities supervisor, and he works early so he can get home and ferry around his overscheduled kids. Jackson never went to college.
Coming up, I wanted to be a chef, but I had to come out of high school and help pay bills for my mother.
Jackson climbed the middle class ladder himself, graduated to a life in Charles County, and he wants his kids to stay there. Growing up, he was mugged, carjacked, shot at.
No food in the house. Waking up in the middle of the night, no electricity. I will never go back to any of that. I'm going to make sure that they have every opportunity that I did.
Opportunities cost money. Camps, tutors, living in a good school district. Take the Jacksons and baseball. This is the next evening.
3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
The price tag per season here is easily $1,000 per kid. All three children see the personal trainer at $20 a pop. Five iPhones run $300 a month. And there's the travel team costs.
From July until mid-August, we will probably have stayed in 4 or 5 hotels and traveled over 2,000 miles.
And then there's Connor's baseball bat. $179. Are you kidding me? His dad said that too, till he saw it turn on a fastball.
It's a big difference from a $40, $50 bat. It's a big difference, man. And that's where you say you got to pay to play.
Pay to play is the theme of this arms race, from the baseball bat to the clarinet. Sound nuts? Well, it may actually be an economically rational choice. Paul Tuff, the author of How Children Succeed, explains.
There's evidence that the more selective college you go to, the more likely you are to earn a lot of money when you get out of that college. And getting into a selective college means doing well on tests and on grades and on extracurricular activities, and a lot of those do come with a price tag.
But here's his concern. These learning opportunities, private school tutors, buying into a good school district, travel sports, they're only available to the better off.
There is this bigger social question of what it means when something like education becomes a consumer good rather than a public good.
And there's this issue. If every family spends to boost their kids' future, every single kid gets a boost. No one moves up in the order. They've just spent more.
We can't be like the rich if you're not rich.
That's Michelle Singletary. She writes the Color of Money personal finance column for the Washington Post, and she's raising her own family in the county next door to the Jacksons. But now she's talking to me as I make the case for spending $1,500 on travel soccer for my second grader. It gets her going.
So if you don't have any credit card debt and you don't have any other consumer debt and you're saving at a comfortable rate for your retirement, both of you, and you're saving at a comfortable rate for your children's college education, all of them, if you can't answer yes to all of those questions, you cannot afford that $1,500 check.
Ooh, silence.
And she says, think through where the arms race goes and the people it's produced, say on Wall Street. Get ready for a provocative argument.
Those people pushing those mortgages to people who couldn't afford it, they weren't thinking about the people who were signing on the other side of that table. How could you in good conscience have people sign those kind of mortgages? Who raised that kind of person? It's the people who are pushing and pushing their kids and pushing their kids to succeed. That's who raised that kind of person.
Hey, get a good look before you shoot.
always.
So I put all this to the Jacksons. Is it worth it? As they see it, it's already paid off. Their daughter Jada got a full academic ride to a nearby college based on her grades and her student government and track and field record.
Academics, it's okay, but athletic-wise, if you have that wow factor, you will reap all the benefits that even a 4.1 or 4.2 student would not be able to get.
The hope, the gamble, is that the younger kids get scholarships too. If not, there will be tough choices.
If I have to get another job, work two jobs to make sure that they're able to go to college and be afforded that opportunity, I will do that. And one thing I will tell you, this is sort of personal, I don't mind applying for loans.
As for other trade-offs, their insane schedule has cost her and her husband some relationships with old friends.
They've fallen off. I'm not saying that they're no longer friends, but I guess it's been a bad taste in their mouth about how we are so, they seem to think that we are fanatics about it, but it's just that we put our children first.
We're paying this now, you know, baseball bats, football equipment, fees, gas, is so that they can have an opportunity to be noticed and recognized by these schools out here to get them what they want and where they want to be in life.
So, Kai, that's basically Lewis Jackson's answer to whether we can afford this consumer arms race.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds crazy, but for his family, he says they can't afford not to.
Scott Tong out of Charles County, Maryland for us. Scott, thanks a bunch.
All right, you're welcome.
Coming up,
there was this idea that the purpose of production was to build up treasure or something.
We go way, way back to the start of this buying and selling thing. Adam Smith explained as consumed continues. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 9 points today, less than a 10%, closed at 15,238, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ gained 4 points, about a 10%, 3473, the number you're looking for. The S&P 500 shaved off less than a point. Let's call that flat, finished at 1642. All right, so we'll start with the building block of the consumer economy. New home construction up in many places, so much that builders have trouble finding skilled workers. Lots of new subdivisions out there. Not a good day, however, in the markets for big home builders. Lennar fell 3.5%. Toll Brothers down 3%. D.R. Horton and Pulte both lost about 2% apiece today. The banks that finance home buyers' mortgages, Citigroup up 0.6%. J.P. Morgan Chase added 0.2%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Netflix Instant Streaming. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your computer, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. Streamed now by Netflix, a great value. Netflix Streaming has lots of movie and television options, including past seasons of House of Cards, Breaking Bad, and Arrested Development. Watch them using Netflix Instant Streaming and find thousands of other TV series and movies during your free 30-day trial at Netflix.com/APM.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on wholesale inventories and sales for April. In Los Angeles, the computer and video games trade show E3 gets underway. And you may have seen him last night on the season finale of Game of Thrones. Actor Peter Dinklage turns 44. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. There were some bankruptcy filings today to take note of. The biggest privately held envelope company in the country, National Envelope, has gone broke. Makes sense if you think about it. Exide Technologies as well. It's a leading battery maker, lead acid batteries to be precise. Also makes sense if you think about it. But the thing is, corporate bankruptcies are actually way down right now, thanks in part to the fact that with interest rates as low as they are, businesses with big debts can often borrow their way out of trouble. So, what gives with the companies that do go under? Marketplace's Chrissy Clark reports.
David Skeel teaches bankruptcy law at University of Pennsylvania, and his self-proclaimed goal in life is to persuade you and the rest of the world that bankruptcy
is actually incredibly interesting.
He is aware that so far, relatively few humans share this view.
We're still small, but we're growing.
Part of what makes bankruptcy so interesting, it's all about failing. And who doesn't like watching that? Footnote here about the popularity of American Idol.
I need your love.
Thank you, Jennifer.
give me your love.
No, we're not going to give you any love.
Like poor Jennifer, there's probably a pretty good reason why certain companies aren't getting any love, says Professor Skeel.
You're not likely to end up in bankruptcy unless you've got real problems with your business.
In some cases, a particular company makes a wrong turn. In other cases, it's the whole industry that's changing. Think Kodak and film, or that envelope maker. How many envelopes have you dropped in the mailbox lately? Then there's the solar industry. It's also seen a boom in bankruptcies now that rates for conventional energy have dropped and the government stimulus money that helped jumpstart solar has dried up. As for all those companies that are avoiding bankruptcy right now with cheap loans, they shouldn't be gloating, says Stephen Lubbin, a bankruptcy expert at Seton Hall Law School.
If they're able to refinance and put off addressing real problems with the business, they may just be putting off their pain to a later date.
Most loans will have to be paid off in the next couple years, Lubbin says, when interest rates probably won't be so low. I'm Chrissy Clark from Marketplace.
All right, let's pick up with Consumed, our series this week about us and the consumer economy. All that suburban competition that Scott Tong was talking about before the numbers probably wasn't what Adam Smith was thinking about when he wrote The Wealth of Nations more than 200 years ago. He was trying to explain how an economy works and how it grows. So he spent a lot of time talking and a lot of time writing, 1,000 pages or so, I think, about how we consume and how we should consume in a capitalist economy. Among Smith's many fans is political satirist P.J. O'Rourke, who has himself written a book about Adam Smith's book. It's called On the Wealth of Nations. P.J., welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I have to tell you, I quote you quoting Adam Smith all the time. You want to know what I quote?
Tell me.
All right. It's this great line. It's about halfway through the actual Adam Smith book and right at the front of yours. It says, consumption is the sole end and purpose of all production. Boom. Done.
Yeah, because otherwise, what's it there for? Right. I mean, if you're making paper cups, you know, and you got 10 billion paper cups and nobody wants to drink out of paper cups anymore, what are you in business for? But, you know, that was an idea that was not current when Adam Smith was thinking about all this. There was this idea that the purpose of production was to build up treasure or something. The idea that it was for the sake of consumers, it just hadn't occurred to the human brain before Adam Smith.
And yet it is clear that in a way he was wrong, right? Because we can't just keep on consuming. I mean, you look around today and it's just not tenable. It's not sustainable.
Well, what he meant by consumption and what we mean by consumption are two different things. By consumption, he really meant that the purpose of all production is to make something that's useful. He was not thinking about buying a whole mess of T-shirts from a shady factory in Bangladesh. You know, he was not thinking about consumer electronics. The word had a different nuance at the time.
The question, though, PJ, is, you know, as Adam Smith comes up with this theory, and it's all about self-interest and division of labor and freedom to trade, which is great in 1776 England, but you make that 2013 America, and the question is, how long can it keep going like this?
Well, see, I wouldn't call what Smith did a theory. I would call it an analysis.
Okay.
If you talk to most businessmen, they won't really acknowledge. I mean, they'll say that what they do is for the public good, but you know in their heart they're just greedy. You know, I mean, what they're doing, they're just doing this for profit. And consumers are just consuming for, you know, the sake of their own greed. But, you know, Smith, who pointed out that the system actually produces some very good things. And we wouldn't have any of those good things if we didn't have this system of pursuit of self-interest.
Yes, but here's the thing. This is all really well and good in theory, but as we sit here in the early 21st century, you have consumers piling on debt until they can't see anymore. You have companies doing what they will to maximize their profit at the expense of those consumers. How far are we from this ideal that Adam Smith set up?
Ah, but it's not an ideal.
Sure it is.
No, it really isn't. What Adam Smith was trying to do was explain how economic progress happens.
Yeah.
The mechanics of economic progress were just completely
ununderstood at the time that he wrote The Wealth of Nations. Adam Smith's huge failure was the fact that he did not foresee the Industrial Revolution. But then when you come to the follies of capitalism, he knew exactly about the business of loading on debt. He was opposed to idiocy. He was also opposed
to... That's a good line.
To,
I like that.
You know, as even the smartest among us has, he had his blind spots. So I wouldn't say that anything Adam Smith had to say has been superseded. But, of course, a whole lot of situations have arisen that Adam Smith could not very well foresee all those years ago, and we have to come up with answers for those.
It's on us now. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it is.
The book by P.J. O'Rourke about a book that Adam Smith wrote is called On the Wealth of Nations. P.J., thanks a lot.
You're very welcome.
Tomorrow on Consumed, it pretty much boils down to this.
Would you like fries with that?
The art of the upsell. Companies trying to sell you something more, something pricier, because they have to in an economy where every company has to grow all the time.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, spotted on the pages of the Drudge Report this afternoon, Amazon, it turns out, has a special page that lists what it calls movers and shakers, books that had the biggest gains in sales over the past 24 hours. Coming in at number 17 out of all the zillions of books Amazon sells, 1984 by George Orwell, whence we get Orwellian and Big Brother, just to get it back to the news of the day. Sales of 1984 have doubled since yesterday. Which goes to prove what I always say. You can get business and economics news into pretty much anything. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off 9 points, less than a 10%. The NASDAQ up 4 points, about a 10%. The S&P 500 down 0.1%, or, you know, flat. Our producers include Lana Anwar, Bridget Bodner, Gina Delvac, Mary Dew, Nancy Vargalli, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Jolie Myers, and Chow Tu. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you back in L.A. tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.